Good afternoon, dear listeners and watchers all over the place. And the reason I say listeners is because this episode will also become a podcast on Muslimish freethinkers. Welcome to another episode discussing blasphemy laws and the goal of Muslimish of abolishing blasphemy laws, the roadmap. Let me just introduce you to the to Muslimish as an organization. We all know the meaning of the word Muslim, but what is the meaning of the word Muslimish? Ish in English is a linguistic suffix. When added to the end of a word, it converts a noun into an adjective and blurs its meaning, taints it with a little confusion, maybe shocks it with some hesitation and doubt, makes it somewhat or a bit as it is. So Muslimish means somewhat a Muslim. That is, it creates an environment for the Muslim individual to question. The Muslim individual who have inherited the concept of being a Muslim, but he or she wanted a more loose definition than the one he or she has been accustomed to or brought up as. One that maybe interacts positively with their intellectual journey, their personal experience, cognitive analysis, and logical skills. Perhaps his or her questioning of Islam or personal understanding of it almost transition him or her to another version of Islam, which is somewhat similar to the Islam they have inherited, or with some of its features and qualities, or even just its smell or culture. Muslimish opens the door to question and encourages uncertainty and doubt in every inherited or accepted the concept that has not been examined by a free conscious mind. Doubt, in this case, inducts and initiates the question, and the question is the symbol of the movement of the mind towards knowledge. Muslimish erases all red lines before the mind, and the question is the only sacred in Muslimish. It is the means towards knowledge, and if knowledge is endless, then the mean, which is the questioning, becomes also endless in itself. One of the goals of Muslimish is to abolish blasphemy laws across the globe. It also strives to create a safe and supportive and open-minded environment for the exchange of thoughts and ideas among current and former Muslims, also to foster a pluralistic society that respects the rights of all individuals to live according to their conscience. Today with me is the founder and national organization of Muslimish, Ibrahim Abdullah from New York. And also, we have the pleasure and honor to have Mr. Ali Rizvi from Toronto.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, Ali. Ali Rizvi is a Pakistani-born Canadian ex-Muslim atheist and secular humanist writer and podcaster who explores the challenges of Muslims who leave their faith. He writes a column for the Huffington Post and co-hosts the Secular Jihadist for a Muslim Enlightenment podcast together with Armin Navabi. Ali is also the author of The Atheist Muslim, and he currently started a new podcast. What's the name of it, Ali?
Oh, it's called Professional Novice. So I started this during the COVID times, just so we could just catch up with each other and have conversations like we used to before. So,
great.
Yeah.
Also supposed to be with us, Zainab Khan. She's the founder of Mala. Due to family emergency, she is not being able to be with us, but she might join us later. But to introduce her, Mala is the Muslim American Leadership Alliance. It's a 501c3 civic and community organization committed to promoting individual freedom and diversity and to celebrating Muslim American heritage. Zainab is a therapist, painter. She's the co-founder of Mala. And she's a human rights advocate born in the U.S. to Asian immigrants. She became an activist after eye-opening experiences, counseling survivors of domestic violence, and organizing exhibitions for artists facing repression. Hopefully, Zainab will join us later. Welcome, both of you, to this episode of The Roadmap to Abolishing Blasphemy Laws. And Ibrahim will start us up with the conversation.
Awesome. Thank you, Sam, for setting everything up for us. And thank you, Ali, for joining us.
Thank you.
This discussion about abolishing blasphemy laws, I think is the last step that, you know, and the last of the three goals we have at Muslimish: creating a space for discussion, foster a plural society, and the third is abolish blasphemy laws. We have taken steps to achieve the first two goals. The third goal, abolishing blasphemy laws, is the hardest goal and is a goal that we haven't really taken any solid steps in achieving, except in gathering support through the meetings and gathering support through growing membership and growing awareness. But the feeling is that we need to start taking definite steps and start putting out ideas to achieve that goal. There's, you know, Ali, I've been rereading your book, The Atheist Muslim, you know, in preparation for, you know, having this discussion today. And I find it to be very inclusive of a lot of the arguments and very educational. The thing that I feel like we're still missing in our movement, if we can call it that, is what are we actually going to do to change the laws? In my research, I've found some work that's been done by different organizations on the UN side. There's really, I feel like the UN already has the Declaration of Human Rights, which says there shouldn't be blasphemy laws, but nobody follows that. Mm-hmm. So what is it? I have some ideas, and I'm going to discuss it with you. But I want you to tell me, what do you think? What do you think we should do? What ideas? What steps we should do to actually achieve the goal of abolishing blasphemy laws where they exist in Muslim majority countries?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. Right. So you have, and I think that what we need to do is really move into all of the resources we have now that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Maryam Namazi, she's a hero of mine, you know, one of the founders of the movement, a pioneer, and her quote that the internet is doing with Islam today what the printing press did with Christianity in the past, that is really the key to everything. So we have to think about this differently. We have precedent. So when you've had monumental changes at this level recently in the last 10, 15 years, what have we seen? We've seen, in Egypt, we've seen the fall of Mubarak. We've seen these entrenched dictators that were in power for decades, right? And they've been brought down by mass protests. And these mass protests, how were they organized? They were organized, well, Wael Ghanim, right? He organized the Egyptian protest on Facebook, right? On Twitter, for instance, in Iran, people didn't really know that there was an uprising against the clerical establishment in Iran, right? The hardline government there. But thanks to videos on YouTube and Twitter, we have been able to see what's going on over there in a way that we never did before. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, and I'm an old man, Ibrahim, I'm, you know, in my mid 40s, so. When I was younger, in the 80s, we used to want to know what was happening in Israel and Palestine. And we just saw one side of the picture. I never really knew what the inside of Gaza looked like, or, you know, what was happening in the West Bank. And we read about Ramallah. We saw Yasser Arafat on TV, but that's about it. And then suddenly, in the last 10 or 15 years, we started seeing these videos straight out of Gaza, out of the West Bank, and getting a side of the picture that we hadn't seen before. So there is what we have to do is we really have to, first of all, open up our minds and start thinking, rethinking the connection between, you know, corporate interests versus public interests. Like in the past, in the 80s, I remember we had the hardcore capitalists, you know, we're anti-corporations, you know, the sort of a leftist ideology, and then we had the the individual person and his voice isn't being heard. Now, amazingly, some of the biggest corporations in the world, like Facebook, Twitter, all these social media companies, I mean, they're giants, and for them, the common man's voice is profitable.
Yes,
the alignment between corporate profit and the advantage of every individual's voice has aligned, and that line is blurred a lot. So I think that is a starting point. When you think of grassroots activism, you think of, you know, we used to talk, well, you know, you're just sitting at home and you're just tweeting on your keyboard and you're sitting in your living room and Instagramming on your phone. And what does this mean? They had terms like slacktivism, you know, armchair activism. But these things have come full circle. And we found out that this slacktivism actually means, and it's much, much more consequential sometimes than the actual protests. So, you know, again, we saw this in the Arab Spring. We saw that with the fall of, you know, Gaddafi, the fall of Ben Ali in Tunisia. We saw that the fall of this guy, Mubarak. So the grassroots activism is a completely different thing. And it's an excellent weapon against blasphemy laws. Going about it this way is an excellent weapon against blasphemy laws. And I will give you an example of my friend Haris Sultan. So many of us, I'm an atheist from Muslim background. Mm-hmm. He's also an atheist from Muslim background. He's also Pakistani. He lives in Australia, but he decided to start a YouTube channel in Urdu. So all of the things that people in the secular Muslim movement, the ex-Muslim movement, the Muslimish movement talk about, he decided to speak about them in Urdu to a Pakistani audience. Mm-hmm. Ended up getting tens of thousands of subscribers that are growing exponentially. And he is, again, he's sitting in Australia. So Pakistan's blasphemy laws cannot get to him. The blasphemy laws cannot get to Haris, but Haris can get to the audience in Pakistan in their language.
Yes.
Right? So they're able to reach him. So he is, in a way, in a protected position, he's able to say things that activists, our counterparts in Pakistan, are unable to say without fear of their lives. I noticed something similar when I was writing my book, is that I heard from prominent journalists in Pakistan. I heard from people who were politicians and diplomats who were telling me, like, can you please put this in your book? Make sure you mention this. Make sure you mention that, because we can't speak about this here. And these are activists who speak up about everything. But this is the one taboo, the blasphemy, that they can't touch. And, you know, people like Haris, people like us, we have the power to talk about these things and reach those audiences in a way that was never possible before. And this puts the establishments in those countries, and I'm just giving the example of Pakistan, this could easily apply to Arabic and Farsi and, yes, and all of the other languages as well. The advantage of this is that it puts the establishment there in a bind, because they can only go so far trying to block videos and trying to block online channels, because, you know, it's whack-a-mole. You hit one down, the other one pops up. So they can't stop that. So they can't punish you or throw you in jail or muzzle you in any way. They can't stop your speech. So they have two choices. Either they can ignore it. If they ignore it, it just gets bigger and bigger, right? Or they can engage with you. Now, if they engage with you, they have to do it. They either have to engage with you in a very aggressive way, in which, if I don't want you on my platform, if you're going to be aggressive with me, I'm like, you know, Haris can say, well, yeah, no, I'm not talking to you because you're coming from a place of bad faith. So not only do they have to engage with you, but they have to engage with you in a respectful way. They have to come from a place of good faith. And this has been happening. So this is just one example with Haris, is that on his channel, he actually ended up getting one of the most prominent actors, a very celebrity in Pakistan, named Hamza Ali Abbasi. He ended up getting him on the show for several episodes, and they had several conversations. It turns out that the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, ended up watching a few of those videos, as far as we know.
Yeah.
And so this is, and I'm not saying that Imran Khan agrees with Haris or anything, but this is it's a very, very powerful way to actually just, even while we're in quarantine, even while we're sitting here, you know, using, it's not necessarily labored activism, but it's smart activism.
Yes.
It's smart. And it can get to people. It puts the establishments in these countries in a bind. It makes them very nervous that they're losing control of their youth and they're going somewhere else. And I'm pretty sure you're familiar with Arabic YouTube, like, yes, secular YouTube and ex-Muslim YouTube. I mean, it is absolutely...
And others. So a couple of things. I think the quarantine has put us, and Wissam says this, quarantine has put us on even footing with the religious establishment. They right. don't have mosques now. They still have to use Zoom like us, and that kind of like have made things a little bit equal for a short period of time. And it's mm-hmm. a good thing we were, I think, and again, I'm going to go to something you said in your book, which is like, we're a long way from where we were with when the Satanic Verses came out. Mm-hmm. It's, we've seen the change happen. And the reason I want to like focus on abolishing blasphemy laws is because I feel like it's the next step. I feel yes. like we have been doing a lot in terms of podcasting and social media outreach that, and it's been going on for 10 years or more. And it's almost all in the educational side. It's from like the grassroots point of view. We wanna grow a big base that will demand the change. Mm-hmm. I also want to think about going top down. You know, I'm wearing my Slytherin T-shirt today because I'm like trying to come up. Well, can we like be a little bit more Machiavellian, pragmatic? Can we work with a secular dictator to try to force the change of blasphemy laws top down? And let me try to elaborate a little bit on that, because I know this is kind of a controversial idea. And when I mentioned it before, I got a lot of pushback. But I'm not saying it's the right idea. I just like to throw ideas out there, and I want to create that atmosphere where we can just like, let's throw some ideas out. Maybe one of them will be a good one. But in Egypt, for example, the constitution changed 3 times in the last 7 years. The examples that we've seen where secularism has been implemented, whether it's in Turkey or, you know, with Ataturk long time ago, or with, you know, in Tunisia, it's always been, it wasn't always the will of the people. It wasn't always a democratic decision that we're going to move in a secular direction or remove a little bit of the religious restrictions on people. This is not something that I see the secular movement even thinking about or discussing at all. And I just want to put it on the table, and in an attempt to stir the pot a little bit and get some different ideas that maybe they're not right, maybe they're wrong. Maybe the only reason we put them out there is so we can scratch them and say, no, this is a bad idea, we're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. But I would like to move the conversation towards having solid steps to changing blasphemy laws. We had that opportunity in Egypt 3 times in the last 7 years. The constitution was changed 3 times in 7 years. Mm-hmm. And that specific part where having Islam as a sort of legislation, which kind of links to, it's like the second amendment of the constitution, it's in Egypt, and it's talking about Islam is a source of legislation. And they spent hours and every time they change, they talk about, is it a source of legislation? Is it the main source of legislation? Is it like just the wording of that? And that wasn't even in the Egyptian constitution until the 70s, when Sadat was trying to push back against the the communist socialist effect of Nasser before him. Mm-hmm. And he got the Brotherhood out of prison so they can fight the socialists that, you know, were supported Nasser. And they ended up killing him. Anyway, is that something that we should talk about? Is it something that we can achieve? I know that it would be helpful to somebody who is fighting, you know, militant Muslim groups, even if they weren't really secular, even if they were trying to appear as secular. Go ahead.
I just wanted a clarification. So you're talking about, are you specifically talking about doing the kind of thing that Ataturk did, or doing
Well, we're not in a position to do that, but I want to be in a position to present a strong front that can back these changes. Like, so in Egypt, for example, and this is the country that I know most about, so I'm going to talk about it. The Brotherhood were ready when Mubarak was toppled to get their agenda in. There was no secular organization ready
to do that.
That's one thing. The other is, if there's no revolution and if it's still going to be the same way that it is, can we work as a secular groups in the US and Canada with with governments in the Middle East that are not democratic governments mm-hmm. to try to abolish blasphemy laws or make the freedoms of speech restrictions less. Maybe that's something we can do as well. I don't know. I'm just
throwing out here. So I think that that's problematic. Just generally, whenever you're working with secular dictators to work on freedom of speech and blasphemy, at the heart of blasphemy laws is abolishing them is the idea of freedom of speech. It becomes a problem. There's also another issue with much of the Arab world and even the Middle East and even countries like Pakistan and Iran and so on, is that they don't think of secularism the way that we do here in the West. So they have a very different association with it, right? So they have, for example, you had the Ottoman Empire. You know, the Ottoman Empire broke down. The coming of Atatürk forced secularism into it. A lot of the Arab dictators have been secular dictators, right? They have tried to clamp down on the Islamist elements in their countries. The forced installation of the Shah. Right, the Shah of Iran,
yes,
and backed by Western powers, and this was a secular the dictator as well. So there is the association, and this is one of the reasons when the Muslim Brotherhood came, you said that they were arose and they were ready to go. They had the agenda. It's like they'd been preparing for years because they had. Right. So what happens is that when you do force, via a dictatorship, when you bring in something like secularism, first of all, people start associating secularism with oppression. Right? In the minds of people, everything's about associations. And when you're talking about freedom versus secularism, freedom versus authoritarianism, you want secularism to start being associated with the freedom side, right? Not the dictatorship side. So what happens is that when you have these secular dictatorships, the powers that rise up against it over the years, the only opposition that actually has the organization and the balls, frankly, to rise up against and mount a cogent opposition are these Islamic organizations. So you saw this in Iran way before when the Shah came down, that the revolution was actually pretty multifaceted. You had communists, you had feminists, you had secularists, you had everything. Ultimately, the Islamic component won out.
They killed all the atheists. They hung.
They did. Yeah, in Egypt also, it was a multifaceted opposition.
Yeah,
it wasn't a Muslim Brotherhood opposition. But ultimately, the only forces that were organized, and the way that they do this is like the Muslim Brotherhood. They're known. They didn't just get elected because of their ideology. It's because they have an organized grassroots. They're community organizers, so they also help people with social services. They help them with healthcare. They help them with food. They help them with all of these other things.
Yes.
So you'd have to think a lot bigger. You would actually have to think like they do in terms of what the kind of things they do, because they do win out. Eventually, the opposition against Assad also morphed into a religious opposition, right? So when you have secular dictatorships and they've been entrenched for a very long time, then you run the risk of the opposition against dictatorship taking on the Islamist face. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah,
and then that works counterintuitively. So while in the short term, you might think, and again, in Turkey, we're seeing the same thing with Erdogan. But in the short term, it feels like a good solution, a good possibility to work with the dictators to get this done. But in the long term, especially now that everybody has a voice and everybody's on social media and people are talking, it makes the work that we're trying to do a lot harder. So I would be in favor of using bottom-up approaches and bringing in people who are influential. And this happens, like I gave you the example of Haris Sultan got Hamza Ali Abbasi, who's a celebrity who personally knows a prime minister, so he can potentially, they can have a dialogue where it's not about, okay, you have to listen to what these people are saying, but, or that you have to adopt what these people are saying, but they can say at least, well, let's listen. Let's have a dialogue. Let's actually start talking about these blasphemy laws. I think that's the way to go. It has to be enduring as well. You know what I mean?
Yes. Okay. Sam?
Yes, guys. Sorry, I had to leave a little bit, but I was hearing the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to say something, Ibrahim. I feel that sometimes the terms, especially ones that were most prominent during the 20th century, in today's world, there is a blurring of some of the meanings and definitions. I'll give you some examples. For example, the word democracy. It's a spectrum that when we say democracy or there's a democratic country, we are really not describing a specific thing. We're describing a very general trend. Under it, there might be a various details that are important to the conversation. So I feel that these labels, sometimes they restrict us rather than they restrict the way we're thinking, because we have inherited these terms with the package, that limits what we really want to do. For example, the word dictator. I mean, is Trump a dictator?
Yes. Technically, no. Technically.
Yeah. So that's the thing. You know, when you come to technicality, technically, Sisi is not a dictator. Technically, he's elected, and that's the difficulty with these terminologies. But I feel that when you present what the question is, can you support a secular dictator, or can you seek the help of a secular dictator in abolishing blasphemy laws? The question itself kind of compromises itself by the use of the word dictator. But are we really concerned of are we really when we're focused on accomplishing the end of blasphemy laws, are we pragmatic about accomplishing that? So if an Islamic regime comes into power that will work with us in abolishing blasphemy laws, will we work with them? If a regime that is unfavorable to its people, so, and there is a line that you have to draw once it becomes that this, for example, regime is actually causing harm to the people. That is, kind of every regime can cause harm, but a harm that you can no longer compromise with.
Like Assad's harm, like dropping bombs on civilian
population. Yeah.
Yeah, even Assad, especially in Lebanon, it's a very controversial thing. They tell you that they see that the attempts for reconciliation as sincere for Assad. Some people have these opinions. They see that Assad, so there's prioritization in the Middle East, right? That's an issue. Everyone has a shortcomings, but then when it comes to a bigger challenge, so with the bigger challenge of facing Israel, they say that, okay, we'll ignore the small things and we won't attack Assad right now on his dictatorship, because he's standing against imperialism and Israeli occupation, for example. I'm just telling you that this is one of the opinions that are out there. So
yeah.
I feel that when we use that, we have to be pragmatic at the end of the day. So since our goals are pragmatic, right? And this is one of our successes, and this is why we've been able at Muslimish to have Muslims and non-Muslims and atheists all together, because we're focused on the goals. This is creating a safe environment for dialogue, no matter what the opinions are. One of them is abolishing blasphemy laws. So we don't want any courts that will stop people from speaking their mind, that they will restrict their expression, even if it was blasphemous in the view of religion. So I feel, I don't know. So how do you measure this pragmatism, especially in today's culture? Like, you see the complications today. Almost everything comes in a package. You cannot separate it from each other. And there is a cancel culture, and there is a lot of sensitivities that's taken into place.
Yeah.
How do you...
I use the word, like, what I mean by democracy is that chosen by the majority of people. That's what I mean by that, you know. Which, you know, and I feel that this is a very hard path for us, because trying to get the majority of people when we are not allowed to present our ideas is going to be very difficult, even with the internet. And so that's why I was like just trying to think of, and the reason I'm putting these ideas out is because I feel in the movement that we have become very idealistic in a way. Everybody like is talking about ideals that are like you know, superhuman ideals, like and everybody has to care about every single issue and care about all the causes and support all the causes, and then this the intersectionalism and all that stuff. I don't care. I want one thing done. I don't care about anything else. I'm focused on one goal, and I want one thing done. And you know, I almost to what extent do I not care about the other things? And that's really what I want to get the conversation started on. Are we going to keep our high morals on a pedestal, and we're not going to discuss anything by someone who's not democratically or chosen by the majority of people in the population? Or are we going to say, no, this is a bad person, we can't work with them because they did this and this and this and this?
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. I think that you do need to work with them. If they're in power, that's what you have to do. For the longest time, people used to talk about how the U.S. props up, you know, the Middle Eastern dictators, which it absolutely did. But, you know, to some extent, you know, if that's the situation there, you have two options. You either go in and you remove the dictator and you have to build a nation and whatever it is, bring in democracy from outside, which I don't think, you know, we saw that doesn't really work very well.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, you can work with them because you need to work with them. You know, there are people there. So I agree with you that if there are leaders like that, then you should work with them. You should talk about this to pretty much everybody. Every time somebody goes and one of our leaders, like, Trudeau got in trouble, right? Because he went to Saudi Arabia. He brought up the case of Raif Badawi, mm-hmm. You know, that Saudi Arabia cut diplomatic ties with Canada over, you know, Krista Friedland's tweet and so on. So these things, they do happen. You do bring them up and you talk to them about it. It doesn't always go as planned, but you can try. I'm just not very optimistic that that's going to have that's going to give you the result you want unless you have the people on your side. And this, I think, is the main issue. The main issue, the reason that I think that the only way to be in a position to have a top-down approach is to start from bottom up. People are susceptible right now to what everybody says. Okay, we are not in a position now where, you know, corporations can do whatever they want. Now we have, if you have, you know, a million voices on Twitter slamming Ben and Jerry's for something that they did, then Ben and Jerry's is going to be influenced by that. They're going to change their policy because it matters to them what people think of them.
A million voices slamming Sisi, he's still not going to change what he's doing.
Well, there's the precedent shows that he might. Okay, so if you have enough voices. Now, the precedent, unfortunately, is also in Egypt, and the same thing happened in Mubarak, where there were lots of voices that came up. Eventually, what happens is these million, I know Egypt has a similar situation like Pakistan, where, you know, you have, you know, democracy, and then you have military dictatorships, and military is always powerful than the civilian government, and more powerful than the civilian government, and so on. So it's a familiar situation, but eventually what happened with the Mubarak protests is that, you know, they got people in the military, they got people in the government on their side. You know, they ended up joining the grassroots movement, and that actually helped. It didn't really give the dictator much of a choice. Now, would it take several attempts to get that done eventually? Possibly, but you know that it's possible. We know that it's possible. We've seen grassroots movements get up and completely change the world, including including Islam, the creation of Islam, right? I mean, that was a grassroots movement.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the way to get top down. And right now, we just have a really, really powerful tool right now. And this is the example I was giving you about Haris Sultan. I actually want to talk about another thing that happened recently. Yasser Qadhi, you know, is one of the most prominent Western scholars, yes. Western Islamic scholars. And he has become very, very controversial recently because there are, you know, for a lot of the lay people, the Muslim lay people don't really know this, but there are many different versions of the Quran. There are several different versions of the Quran that have, you know, how we're taught that not even a dot has changed, not a single letter has changed. Simply not true. There are entire words, there are entire verses, there are differences.
There are 27 different Qurans in Arabic that you can buy today in Arabic.
And exactly. So what Abdullah Gondal, who's, you know, one of these, also another sort of YouTuber, and Abdullah Sabir, and these are people now who have tens of thousands of subscribers, and they're only growing, and they've had millions and millions of views on their YouTube channels. They did an entire session on, is the Quran preserved? And they went line by line. And on the most recent episode of Secular Jihadists, we spent 2.5 hours going through all of the differences between these different Qurans. And these are conversations that are happening that are causing problems. So this guy, Yasser Qadhi, is on a YouTube interview with one of these Islamic Dawah preachers named Muhammad Hijab. Mm-hmm. And Muhammad Hijab asks him about it. And his answer was equivocal. It was ambiguous. And he said, well, it's complicated. And then he went on to say, he's like, this is not something I want to talk about in public. This is something we talk about in academia, because in academia, everybody knows about it. And, you know, you can enroll in my course and I'll teach you, but I don't want to talk about this in public. So Muhammad Hijab went and he deleted that entire 30 minutes part of the interview, which was still up on other places. Mm-hmm. And it caused an entire furor. And this is something that happened because this conversation busted out into the mainstream. This was protected in Islamic academic circles. I mean, it's something that's been known for centuries. Okay, but nobody really talked about it in the public, because the public narrative was that this is the unaltered, you know, literal word of Allah that has been protected by Allah Himself. Well, turns out not so much, right? And this is a kind of, now when this comes out, this is obviously something that would be considered blasphemous, but at the same time, people in academia believe in it, and now you're talking about, well, should we be able to talk about it or not? Well, these people are talking about it. Can we do anything against them? No, we can't really do anything against them because they live in Canada. But all of our youth is watching this. They're all more and more. It's getting more and more views. So what do? We can either ignore it and it'll get more and more and more views. Or we have to talk to this guy who's doing it. We're going to have to engage him in dialogue. We can't throw him in jail. We have to engage him in dialogue. So let's engage him in dialogue. And then when they engage him in dialogue, the whole thing busts out openly. And when that happens, that is the way to get the conversation going.
So then,
So
what you're presenting is fighting blasphemy laws by flooding the media outlets with conversations about, you know, blasphemous conversation.
Using the tools that we have today, being able to, because, you know, we can have this conversation on YouTube. And this conversation would be a huge problem in a lot of Muslim majority countries, right? But we can do it, and we can reach their audiences. If we were having this conversation in Arabic or Urdu or Farsi or Malay or Indonesian, in any of these other languages, they would reach the people in those countries in a way that the activists in those countries can't reach it. And that is why you're seeing, you know, as Ibrahim, you mentioned that I was talking in my book about how we're a long way from when Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses came out. In terms of years, we're not really. I mean, that was just about 30 years ago. It's 30 years, okay? Mm-hmm. Since then, I remember I saw the Danish cartoons of Muhammad in 2006, and I thought, I was shocked. I had never seen it. And I was like, wow, someone actually drew him. And now it's normalized. No one cares. Blasphemy, in a way, has been normalized. I get more sort of, I remember a time when I used to get death threats every single day. I get more death threats right now. Not that many, no, but I get way more from these, some of these white supremacist types than I do from the Allahu Akbar types. I mean, it's a very, very different landscape, and it's okay to acknowledge that. There are people who say, why are you saying that it's still a serious situation? Of course, there is a serious situation. There are a lot of people who are still at great risk right now. As you know, like, for example, Haris Sultan, he had threats against his family that he had to handle.
Yes.
And the difference is that he was able to handle them, and he got those people to apologize to him in public who did this, right, by getting law enforcement involved. And things are, if we don't acknowledge that there's been any progress in 30 years, then everything we're doing is useless anyway. Right? And there has been a massive amount of progress, and a lot of it, the large chunk of it has been because of getting online and because of social media and, you know, this, what they used to call the lazy tweeting from your armchair type thing. But it's something that is actually making waves in a way that none of us could have if we were doing it the old way in our country.
So question, Ali, Ibrahim, if you permit me. We've been discussing this in Muslimish, and you know, most Muslimish members are non-Arabic speaking, and we've done all our programs in English and focused on English audience. We've attempted to do something in Arabic a couple years in Detroit. We did half of the conference in Arabic and then half of it in English, and created that material. There wasn't any significant results that encouraged us to do this more. And recently we've done the interview with Muhammad Hisham. We gave him the opportunity to answer the interview questions that he got kicked out from in Egypt.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I missed that. I have to see it. Yeah.
We played it piece by piece, the 16-minute interview that he was live. We played it piece by piece, and we gave him the opportunity to comment, and it took 2 hours to do that. But also, we had a lot of views on the promotion. We had like 25,000 views on the promotion, and hundreds of comments on Instagram and Facebook. Most of it are hate comments, but we didn't have really participation in viewing the show when we had it. So what I'm saying is, we haven't had a lot of encouragement to do programs in Arabic, but according to what you're saying and the Haris Sultan experiment and what Elishba is doing also in Urdu, right? You encourage Muslimish to do Arabic programs, more Arabic programming for the Arab world?
I do. Yeah, I think that, and you know, your experience, it doesn't always hit immediately. So, for example, the Abdullah Gondal view of the opinion, the example I was giving you about him, you know, pointing out all of the different differences in the different Qurans. So he did this video called "Is the Quran Preserved?" It was actually a PowerPoint preservation presentation with the you know, screenshots of the different verses and so on. And he did this in 2018, and you know, it was slow. It didn't really catch on that much. But now this whole thing has exploded. Sometimes it takes a while for these conversations to really get out there, and you have to keep on trying. And all of us started, you know, I know that there were articles that I wrote back when I didn't have any platforms that barely got any traction. So I thought, well, nobody cares about this topic. And then I repost it, you know, 5 years later when I do have a platform, and suddenly it goes everywhere. So a lot of this really comes down to exposure more than anything else. And I think, you know, I was talking to Ibrahim about this earlier. You know, the Arabic YouTube, Arabic ex-Muslim YouTube and atheist YouTube is a massive thing. It's full of people who are hafiz. Like they have Qurans memorized. These are people who are sons of imams, and it's absolutely astounding. I don't know the language, unfortunately. So I can't, enjoy it as much. They're also not burdened by, you know, what the people will think. Will the far right co-opt us? Or, you know, they don't have to worry about those things. Yeah.
It's a very, very different conversation.
Completely different. And it's sophisticated. It's smart. And they're really talking about the things that matter. And, you know, I in Egypt, in Malaysia, in Turkey, in Iran, people are worried about this. They're worried about the rise of atheism in the youth. Right, it's something. Poll after poll is showing how big of an impact it's having. So it's just a matter of, you know, you're at the point right now where you're drawing the dots, you're making the dots. You can connect them later.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to be able to connect them immediately. But this is a long-term project. I mean, there is a, we tend to like immediate gratification, right? As we all do. I mean, this is, yeah. You know, should we do this? But sometimes, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are immediate things that you can do. I think activism that is sort of really in your face and aggressive, there's a big place for that. The only problem is that if we do something like that and it backfires on us, for instance, you know, a lot of secular Muslims are forming alliances with the far right because they thought the left betrayed them. So now they're going to another platform, which is, I mean, you left a far right ideology, right? Which is, you know, Islamic theocracy and so on. And now you're moving to another sort of far right platform just because they're giving you a voice. Ultimately, that hurts. That hurts all of us. It hurts us in the long term. So when we look for short-term solutions that might seem flashy and they might present some kind of advantage in the short term, I think we just have to be mindful about what we want to achieve in the long term.
Yeah, and I think both you and I, Ali, and I think Wissam as well, we're all optimists in terms of, we all think like we're going to achieve, this goal is going to be achieved at some point in the future.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It happened. Even if we don't do anything about it, I think.
Yeah.
But I want to see it in my lifetime. And that's why I'm, you know, I want to see something in my lifetime. You know.
Ibrahim, you will. And I have to, there is another aspect of this that you have to understand. So Canada had a blasphemy law that was only repealed 2 years ago. Okay. So until 2018, they had a blasphemy law. But it was never enacted. Nobody really cared about it. It was just sort of like sitting there in the books, and people, there were activists who said, okay, we have to get this out of the books. And they did it 2 years ago, Canada. Okay. Now, what happened ultimately in a lot of these Western countries, like Ireland had one, the US, all of these countries had blasphemy laws, is that it was the people who eventually started not taking it seriously. So even though it was still on the books and it shouldn't be on the books, but even though it was still on the books, ultimately, it was people who decided that, okay, this blasphemy, it's ridiculous. And people were surprised to even know there was a blasphemy law. So so you can have the opposite situation too. You can go and work with the leaders in Bangladesh, say, you know, we got to get rid of this blasphemy law. So they get rid of the blasphemy law. But the next time a secular blogger is killed, right, the government will say, well, you know, there's no law against blasphemy. He shouldn't have been killed. But at the same time, look, you know, why was he writing what he was writing? So they're okay with throwing them to the mob. And to me, that's a bigger problem. The bigger problem is really
the mob. Yeah.
Is the mob. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and the way that people think differently. So, you know, you have this contrast. You have official blasphemy laws, but you have a population that really thinks that blasphemy is a ridiculous concept. On the other hand, you have places that have no blasphemy laws, but you have this mob mentality that completely works as a de facto blasphemy law anyway.
But so we don't want to lessen of the importance of the laws too, Ali.
Yeah, that's why we had it removed in two years ago.
Yeah, in Michigan, we have blasphemy laws. You cannot take the word of God in vain in the Michigan. But of course, it's not implemented because in court it doesn't stand against the First Amendment. So I feel, I don't know about the Canada's case, but as far as U.S., the leftover blasphemy laws in the books of states, they're not really taken into consideration because there's the First Amendment that wipes out everything. But we don't have First Amendments in our countries. And, you know, at the end of the day, like we are, we know that we are protected in the United States, like for example, United States or Canada, we are protected at the end of the day. Even if there is a mob, you know that the government will protect you. You know, because you have a government that backs your freedom of speech. So that plus the grassroots movement together, working together, I feel it's the optimum solution.
Definitely. Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think that you have to do both. And there were petitions, and there was a lot of activism that led to with the blasphemy law being struck down in Canada 2 years ago, even though blasphemy is not really as serious a situation here when it comes to the population. But so I think, yeah, it is absolutely essential to have the laws off the books, because you know what they do. I mean, we've seen this with Trump as well. They'll find all these old archaic laws. Well, maybe we can use this to justify me asking Ukraine for, I don't know what that law he brought out from, I don't know, ages ago, where, you know, he asked Ukraine for help and research against Biden or whatever. So they can do that. Anytime you have a demagogue or some kind of opportunist who comes into power, they can misuse it. And we shouldn't take that for granted either. So I agree that it should be on both fronts. But I do think that we're going to see something in our lifetime. One of the reasons I'm an optimist is because I have been doing this for many years, like you guys have, and I've just seen a massive amount of change. I've seen a complete change in the conversation. We've gone from the sort of the new atheism, where everybody was trying to raise awareness that there are these issues, and now we're at the point where this next generation of activists is actually engaging in conversations, and they're engaging people within the community, and people know. And I think that's a massive achievement in less than 10 years.
Yes. Right.
So we just have to keep on going and not get too, just keep the long-term goal in mind.
Yeah. And, you know, part of the reason we, you know, invited you to this conversation is that we want you and others who are thinkers and leaders in the movement to have that goal of abolishing blasphemy laws up there and list of goals that we want to achieve. I feel that it's a very important goal, and I just feel that it's not being talked about enough, or it's not being focused about enough. There's a lot of focus on educating the general public, which is great, and I think is you know, in the long term will get the goal achieved, but there is less of trying to work with the powers that are ruling in the current moment, because there is like this sort of looking down on them. There is this very high and mighty, very high moral general sense in the movement, I feel. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just, you know, I'm the slithering guy here.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to is there something else we can do? Can we like be a little less perfect and get something done? And I feel that in terms of like the ends justifying the means part, I feel like if we change very little in terms of law, it will have very fast effect on people who are living under very difficult circumstances. In terms of really honestly women's rights and inheritance laws and being able to even speak about that and having that's going to affect millions of people instantly if we can get this change.
I think the thing is that we need to talk about it, because I work in messaging and I work in communications now, and one of the problems I think when it comes to blasphemy laws is the way that we talk about it. When we just say blasphemy laws, it seems like this sort of clinical term, this archaic thing. But people don't realize that blasphemy laws are the reasons that I can't go to the house that I grew up in and visit that place again. It's the reason that I can't go to the school I grew up in and see some of my old friends. I can't visit certain relatives. It's the reason why, well, you know, Rafia Skoui, who is in, you know, is a Muslimish member and a very vocal Muslimish member, why she wasn't able to see her daughter,
yes,
for many years. Right? There is one of my really good friends, Sean Tasir, is the son of the governor of Punjab, the former governor of Punjab, who was assassinated simply because he showed solidarity with a Christian woman in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Was accused of blasphemy and she was in jail. Asia Bibi was a big case. Yeah. So, there are lives lost because of this. There is a human toll. There are human stories that should be told. And this is the same thing. It's like, you know, how do you get people to care about something? Is, they give the classic example of that if you're scrolling through your Instagram feed and you see a hospital, you know, we have saying that, you know, we have 200 children with leukemia in the hospital, please donate. Most people will just scroll past. But if you see a picture of this one little girl who's got leukemia and everyone says, you know, this is girl, her name is Fatima, you know, please donate to her. She has leukemia. Loads of people will donate, even though it's just one person, because there is a story. They can connect with the image in an emotional way. So one of the things that I think we need to do is engage, not as much, because, you know, we tend to be very cerebral and have these conferences and talk about stats and data and laws and principles, but we don't tell enough stories. And we do. We should start. I mean, one of the biggest successes of Islam was the stories, right? I mean, in all the religions, they use stories, they use art, they use calligraphy, sculpture, music, dance. All, these are the kinds of ways that these are that you get people to emotionally invest and emotionally connect to your cause. And when we talk about abolishing blasphemy laws, we should bring out these stories of people who have suffered because of blasphemy laws, and show what the real human consequence of them are. And I think that communications wise, that would probably raise a lot more awareness and people connect with it a lot more too.
Awesome. We're coming to an end of the episode. So I'm going to recap what you presented, Ali, today. But before that, I want to say that there's a couple conversations that we might have to also, they need to take place maybe in future episodes that are closely related to this issue, is that blasphemy laws is really the soul of blasphemy laws is an intolerance to other opinions. And sometimes we need to have the spirit of tolerance of diversity of opinions. We need to also solidify that spirit, because that has to do with blasphemy laws. You might change the books, but as Ali said, that at the end of the day, you know, you might be able to say whatever you want, but you might be not invited to speak ever, or you might be, you know, boycotted. So that's another way society can practice blasphemy laws on you. So maybe the concept of cancel culture and the concept of intolerance, maybe also we need to talk about it.
Yes. Yeah.
The spirit behind blasphemy laws, which we suffer from it. Like sometimes we have to also self-critique. Even the left, you know, sometimes suffers from that. So at the end of our episode, I'd like to recap what Ali Rizvi has presented as some of the most important ways as the roadmap to abolishing blasphemy laws. One is basically producing and carrying these conversations through the way of enlightenment of the 21st century for the Muslim world, which is the internet. Flooding the outlets with conversations that are considered blasphemous to a point where governments and laws have to submit to change. And second, humanizing the stories behind blasphemy laws, because blasphemy laws sound archaic, and we need to bring that subject into life. How is it affecting our life, and why is it important? Is that a good summary, Ali?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. And the one thing I would stress enough is that don't let anybody tell you that you are a slacktivist or you're just doing online activism. Online activism has been much more powerful than the real thing now, because we are able to say things right now to people in our countries of origin and get that audience to listen to us without any fear. Any security concerns, and we are able to force the establishments there to engage with us because of our influence. So I think that is this is a huge channel that we must exploit as much as we can.
Thank you, Ali. Any final words, Brahim?
No, thank you so much, Ali. And I just, you know, thank you. I appreciate your input, and I just want to ask you to keep that thought in your mind and present it as one of the things of the goals that we want to achieve. I just want to put it on the agenda of the movement, that it's not only about educating the general public, that there is actual law that we need to change. Mm-hmm. And I feel that gets lost some way, or gets forgotten, or gets ignored a little bit. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe because it's my passion, and I want to see it everywhere. I feel that way. But I wanted to be on your mind as well, because you're definitely someone who influences a lot of opinions, and I wanted in your mind.
No, I really appreciate it. This actually gave me a lot to think about, because as you said, you know, we hear abolish blasphemy laws all the time, but you know, we just tend to think, okay, well, how are we going to possibly do that? So this actually made me think about that, the topic itself. So thank you guys for bringing it up.
Awesome.
Thank you. Thanks to our listeners. This video will be available on YouTube and Facebook, and a podcast on Muslimish Freethinkers. Have a great evening.
Thanks.